Which one?
This is
The House Committee on Education will come to order. It's Monday, February 9th. We are going to do an informational hearing, two informational meetings today, one on educational service districts and one on overview of community colleges and workforce development. House Bill 2208, which changes the name of Department of Higher Ed to the Oregon University System and related to the interest earnings, may be ready for us to work by the end of today, depending on whether or not the revenue and fiscal statements get here. If so, we will come back to that later. We are not ready today to work House Bill 2062 and 2063, so I'm going to briefly open them so that we can roll them over till tomorrow. Representative Roveland isn't here to appreciate all of my wax of the gavel, so you'll have to tell him if I do this right. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2062. I'm going to carry House Bill 2062 over to Wednesday, February 11th for further work session. And now I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2062. I'm now opening a work session on House Bill 2063, and I'm going to carry over House Bill 2063. That's not funny. That's really not funny.
Representative Harker made me do it.
This feels like school.
No, it feels like home. My little brother has followed me to work. House Bill 2063 will be carried over to Wednesday, February 11th, 2009, and I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2063. Representative Maurer, are there any comments before I close it? Thank you. And now I'm going to open the informational meeting, and I would invite Bob Burns, Jim Mabbitt, and Maureen Casey to the dais, please. And while they're coming up, if you would please reach into your pant pocket, your jacket pocket, your backpack, your purse, your jacket, and take out your cell phone and turn it not just to vibrate but to off so that it does not interrupt the sound system here. We're going to have great testimony, and you will want to listen to it again and again and again on the tape, and you'll ruin it for everyone if your phone is on. So please turn it off. Thank you, and welcome, and please proceed in whatever order you think is most useful.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Jim Mabbitt. I'm superintendent of the Northwest Regional ESD and also president of the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts. On my left is Bob Burns, former deputy superintendent of the Oregon Department of Education and a former ESD administrator. And on my right is Maureen Casey, who is the superintendent of the Willamette ESD. And we were asked to come forward and present some information to you. So we're going to spend some time, Maureen will, talking about the history of ESDs to give you a little historical perspective, and also looking at the way ESDs are currently configured in the state. I will follow that up and talk a little bit about ESD funding, so how that works here in Oregon, and then talk about functions of ESDs and give you some sort of picture of how that works, and then a little bit about the local service plan, which every ESD goes through with their local school districts and school boards. And then we'll have time for questions after that. So Dr. Casey is going to start with the historical perspective.
You look at your first page of your hand. For the record, I'm Maureen Casey, superintendent of the Willamette Education Service District. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, your very first page there is a map of the current 20 education service districts in Oregon. I think it's interesting to note that 45 states in the nation actually have ESDs. They're regional education service agencies. They're known by different names in different states. Intermediate units in Pennsylvania, RESAs, regional education service agencies, BOCES in Colorado and the East Coast. They're of the Board of Cooperative Education Services. And in the last 3 years, two states have added ESDs. I think it makes a statement in terms of the need, and as you'll see from our testimony, some would argue that the need has never been greater for some kind of regionalized service structure for cost efficiency. And so we're going to just do a brief history of ESDs in Oregon. And it was the first legislative assembly for the Oregon Territory that actually established county school superintendents. And that happened in 1849. And at that time, there was no state superintendent of public instruction. The governor actually served as the state superintendent. And because of having other duties, education was never the primary duty. And so originally, within the territories, the county school superintendents had considerable responsibility and influence over education, the state of education's development. And then from about 1872 to 1944, the county units became a regulatory arm of the state. So it was the county units, or we'll just call them ESDs at that point, to standardize and maintain school facilities. They managed the teacher contracts and their performance evaluations. They distributed money, and they essentially provided general oversight to the state's educational system. And again, they had some pretty significant responsibility and influence. Then in 1945, the legislature changed the name of the regional agencies from county units to rural county districts, and they did some equalization of funding. Then there's a very significant period is between 1963 and 1976. The legislature once again changed the name to Intermediate Education Districts, or IEDs. And this was a pretty significant, this time was a significant shift in the core mission of ESDs. Because up until that point, they had been essentially administrative. And now, during this period, they moved into becoming significant service organizations, providing direct instruction, support services. And the impetus for change actually came around the mid-70s with the Uvalde Hearing about Public Law 94-142, which is currently called IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Act. And in the mid-70s, when that came into existence, there so many of the districts were not equipped to meet the needs of these children. And so ESDs assumed the responsibility for education for severely disabled children. The responsibility was changed from the Department of Human Services to the Department of Education. And then the Department of Education relied on ESDs for the implementation. The other significant thing for ESDs that happened during this period was the legislature adopted the resolution process for ESDs. And this is a significant point, and you'll hear more about it when Jim talks about the local service plans in our current process. This resolution process that the legislature instituted set up a system by which the programs that the ESDs offered had to be approved by their component districts. Two-thirds of the component districts with more than 50% of the students would have to vote for those services to be provided. And so again, this is the foundation for ESDs, and when people talk about collaboration and district input, it's really a collaborative model. If there is a service that a particular region doesn't need, then it will not end up being one of the services that the ESD provides. And all the superintendents come together with the ESD superintendent and go through this process on a regular basis. So everyone talks about, never before than today, about collaboration and finding efficiencies. And it's this model that's been established and well-founded with ESDs that actually provides a process to bring everybody to the table to have those conversations. Then we get to, in your outline, 1977, where the name was changed to from Intermediate Education District to Education Service District, where it remains today. And the legislature made that change because they felt that it reflected the emerging mission of ESDs as service agencies. So then we hit the 90s, and the legislature authorized a task force to study ESDs and to determine if a regional service delivery model in Oregon was really creating efficiencies. And they ended up saying, Oregon needs a regional service delivery model, and they recommended that the model continue, however, that they are needed to be fewer ESDs, and they reduced 29 ESDs to 21. They'd actually recommended 15, but after the hearing process and input from people around the state, it ended up being 21. And then we had ballot measure 5, and there was an equalization piece that came in for ESDs. And at this point, another significant development was it was during this time that the legislature made a decision to dedicate 5% of the state school fund to ESDs. So since that time, 5% would go to ESDs to be distributed, and the 95% remaining would be distributed among school districts. And again, you had that districts in an appropriate decision-making process determining how those funds would be spent. And the key here is that the legislature also designated out of that 5% that was to go to ESDs, 90% of that needed to go out to districts in terms of services. So when you talk about accountability and reporting back to districts and them knowing how the money is spent and where it's going, that is a pretty significant built-in accountability piece. When the Legislative Task Force in 1999-2000 concluded their research, there was another legislative study, Oregon, the end result was, and this was out of the task force report, the recommendation, quote, Oregon needs a statewide system of regional education service agencies. School districts and the Department of Education require services that are most appropriately and cost-effectively delivered at a regional level. Over the years, in addition to the support to the local component districts, ESDs play a major role in terms of supporting the State Department of Education. Over the years, they have become more regulatory in nature than ever, and many of the services, the technical assistance, the support that used to come from the legislature was shifted to ESDs. We work very closely with the State Department of Education in order to fulfill those responsibilities. And that brings us up to 2005, some additional legislation. House Bill 3184 required ESDs to annually develop plans. They called it a local service plan with their component districts. And they said that every ESD in the state would need to offer services in four core areas, and that's school improvement, children with special needs, administrative and support services, and technology. So if you are one of the 20 ESDs, you must provide those services in those four core areas to your component districts, and if for some reason you can't, then you are in a position where you have to broker it for them. Then, you know, the recession hit, money was really tight, and the legislature made a change from the 5% of state school fund that had been going to the ESDs. They lowered it to 4.75% and increased the district's proportionate share of the state school fund by that 0.25%. They also established 3 pilot ESDs, Northwest Regional, Willamette, and High Desert, to try out a different form of governance, board governance. And Jim's going to talk a little bit more about that when he makes his comments. The following pages, the following 2-page back-to-back, gives you a summary of the 11 studies and task force reports that have been conducted with ESDs. There are 12, but one of the 12 is a doctoral dissertation. So 11 studies or task force reports that were commissioned by the legislature or by the State Department of Education. And each, and I think we're right up there with the School for the Blind in terms of the number of reports the number of studies. And so every one of those 11 ended up saying, given what ESDs do, and given the nature of our 197 different districts in Oregon, we believe that we need a regional education service structure in order to provide equity of services across all districts and in order to make sure that all children had equal access to those services no matter where they lived. And I know that many of you are familiar with low incidence, high needs children. Had a lot of time spending on the needs, particular needs of children with who are blind or children who are deaf. And over the course of the ESD's history, when the responsibility from Human Services was turned over to the State Department of Education, the State Department set up regional programs to provide services to children with high needs, low incidence disabilities. And they used ESDs to provide those services because if it was a regionalized model and we had to recruit staff that serve in an area that there is a shortage, not only an Oregon shortage in state, but a national shortage, teachers of the visually impaired, teachers of the hearing impaired, occupational therapists, vision teachers, physical therapists. And so the State Department of Education, when the responsibility was transferred to them, they actually used the ESD structure to create regional services to get those difficult-to-find services to students. And many of you represent areas that you know from your component districts that they have a very difficult time recruiting speech therapists and physical therapists and other teachers. Because of the regionalization that ESDs provide, they have an easier time recruiting staff and maintaining them over time. The other significant shift was early intervention, early childhood special education. The State Department was given the responsibility, transferred from DHS to the department, and they were given responsibility to provide services for children birth to five. And I happen to remember being in the room when those hearings were held. They held them around the state, talking to districts about taking on the responsibility for children with special needs birth to five. And the district said, we simply cannot do it. They knew they felt it would be an unfunded mandate, but they also knew that they were just at that point implementing and recovering from implementation of half-day kindergarten. And they didn't have the facility space, and they didn't have the staffing or the funding. And so once again, the department came to ESDs and said, we have to be coordinating a statewide system that will provide services birth to five. And they asked ESDs to do it. Right now, there are 9 contractors, all ESDs, who are responsible for providing those services themselves or subcontracting to another ESD or agency to make sure within their region that that system is provided. How do you provide services like that without a regionalized structure? It would be very, very difficult. That's the history.
Can I ask you a question? As you raise that issue, and I guess to the question of how well it is working right now, as you know, there was a recent study that suggested that the number of hours that children in early intervention and early childhood special ed are getting has decreased by as much as 40%. How effective do you think the ESDs are at delivering those services, and do you think statewide that the ESDs are in compliance with federal law in terms of the type and amount of service that those children need and in developing the IFSPs based on those kids' needs rather than other considerations?
Representative Gelser, members of the committee, I would say that ESDs have done an exceptional job in terms of providing services to children with special needs birth to five in light of the continued financial struggle. The funding for that program is different than any other program. As you know, it's been funded for the last several via the e-board. So money, the appropriation is made. It's not enough to provide the services. The programs have to come back to the e-board, document that there's been a certain percentage of growth, and then request more money. It's been very difficult to provide services and manage that that program under those circumstances. There was only one private subcontractor in the entire state providing those services, and they gave up the contract because it was way too difficult. So I don't know how you would provide those services if you didn't have an entity like an education service district to provide those services. At the moment, Representative Buckley has a committee pulled together to look at coming up with a funding formula. I think the e-board has recognized last spring that the current funding formula is not working, it's not sufficient, and so they've asked for input, and Representative Buckley is working with the State Department, some contractors, and LFO to try to pull something together that would result in the program being adequately funded so the appropriate level of services could be provided.
And I appreciate that, and certainly Representative Buckley is doing extraordinary work on that issue, which is very important. But I didn't hear the answer to the question. Do you believe that the ESDs are currently meeting federal law, and do you believe that either the individual ESDs or the state could be at risk of a lawsuit from those who have federal mandates to the state in terms of provision of services?
Representative Gelser, members of the committee, given the current situation and the continual erosion of funding, yes, the liability is extremely high.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is one of the issues the fact that when we're talking about early intervention and early childhood services, that it is an allotment not based on the number of children, and that we have far more children than we have money? So, in other words, it isn't, you know, so many dollars per kid. It's you get a lump sum of money, and you need to do what you need to do. Is that?
Representative Gelser, Representative Van Orman, yes, that's accurate.
Thank you.
Representative Tom?
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Dr. Casey, it's nice to see you. I have a question about back in when we did the restructuring to reduce the amount of ESDs to 21. Was there research done at that time that compared us to the state of Washington, Idaho, California, with how many ESDs they have in their states and the amount of students that they provided support for?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Comp, there was some additional research done, and I think Dr. Burns knows about that. And after there were 21, the legislature actually offered the opportunity for voluntary mergers. And I think Willamette ESD is the poster child. We went through we went through not only one, but two mergers. We merged first with Polk ESD, and then we merged with Yamhill ESD. There were no other voluntary mergers. But Dr. Burns was part of the task force that conducted the study for. He was the department staff for the legislative committee, and I would turn it over to him to provide some specific background.
Thank you, Dr. Casey. I have a little bit of a cold I'm struggling with. Representative Kahn, there were extensive discussions and debates and hearings all across the state regarding the appropriate number of education service districts for Oregon. And yes, the committee, it was actually a commission appointed by the legislature, studied a lot of states. Washington, in particular, I remember, because a lot of people from Washington were telling us that they're getting along fine with the number that they have, which is, I think, 8 or 9, something like that.
Nine
now. However, after all the discussions and public hearings, especially in some of the smaller and more remote parts of the state, the debate became more of an employment issue rather than an education issue. And it was very, very difficult for many of the areas to give up their education service district. So it was kind of I'm sure it was a compromise in many people's minds. I don't know how people voted or what was in their minds at the time. You never know that. But they came up with the number of 21 rather than, I believe, 15 were recommended at the time. And then from the 21, now we're down to 20. So that's about all I can remember about it, except I was the hearings officer across the state in many places, and the State Board of Education, the state chair, made a commitment to go to each of the areas that was in jeopardy of losing their ESD. And I can tell you it was pretty difficult conversations in those areas. They wanted their ESD. It was a jobs issue as much as an education issue. And I guess that's what I have to say about that.
Just one follow up, Dr. Casey. Have you done any have you done any cost analysis? And I'm just talking dollars, not education loss, but cost analysis of what the impact has been to have the one consolidation that we might be able to get our hands on to review.
Madam Chair, Representative Comp, we do have an idea of the savings that we realized, especially the result of merging with Yamhill ESD. And it was not only a monetary savings, but because they were a much smaller ESD, mm-hmm. it was increased capacity for the seven districts in that particular county. So they had access to our local service plan, which offered a much broader array of support services. So there were significant impacts within both of those areas.
Thank you.
Representative Parker.
Thanks for that. Just to be perfectly clear, make sure I understood, you were able to merge three into one, realize significant cost savings, offered more.
Madam Chair, Representative Parker, yes, in our particular situation, again, it's different in different areas of the state, but in terms of Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties, yes, it worked really well for us.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
What was the motivation for taking this step? Because I can imagine, as was just provided, that there was incentive job-wise in certain areas to not go through something like you went through voluntarily there. I don't know if there was a change in the number of positions funded or not, but it sounds like something motivated the people in those three ESDs to combine forces, mm-hmm. save money, deliver more to the people they were serving.
Madam Chair, Representative Harker, in Yamhill County, it was actually a request of the seven districts themselves. They were interested. They went to Yamhill ESD's board, and they shared with them that they were interested in exploring the merger because they felt that they could realize greater capacity and get more support for their students. In terms of the services, you know, the services are not reduced. The reduction comes in terms of administration, mm-hmm. coordination, mm-hmm. business managers. You don't need two business managers. You can have one business manager for the whole three counties instead of each county individually having their own. So those are some of the realized savings. But in terms of the actual people providing services to children, you don't really see a reduction there because those children still need the services, the same services.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are certainly limits to how far you could take that kind of thinking. Do you have a feel for looking just at the map here and looking at the proximity of those three to some others, do you have a feel for how much we might be able to combine and reap benefits without the problems resulting from such combinations outweighing those benefits?
Chair Gelser, Representative Harker, that's an extremely difficult question to answer. We do know what Maureen said is history and it's fact. We also know that in my region, in Northwest, we took four ESDs and joined them together with similar results. So we know that that's historical and that's fact. I would hesitate, I know Maureen would hesitate, to sit before you today and say economically and as far as services provided, if we join these together, this would be the result. I think as in any economic time like we're having now, I think it would serve the legislature well to study that question and get some answers on that question.
Representative
Van Orman. Madam Chair, Dr. Burns just reminded me that in my former life as a Head Start director, we had three ESDs. We had ESD 112 in Washington State, which stretched from the ocean. all the way up to Goldendale. And we had Hood River and the Columbia Gorge ESD, which combined and became Columbia Gorge ESD. And then we had Jefferson ESD. The issues for Jefferson and Wasco are distance, proximity, and those make lots of challenges for providing services. One of the things that I wondered about, and Bob, maybe you can answer this, is it seemed like ESD 112 had lots of money to do things, and those little buses would be running back and forth from Vancouver up to White Salmon on a daily basis, the special ed buses, which I thought was an interesting approach. So do they have a different taxing situation than we do?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, yes, they're funded totally different. In Washington, they provide services primarily on a contract basis where the services pay for the services. They get a very small state fund, very small state fund. To your other question, I'd like to make a response as well, that in the current statute, there is some criteria under the consolidation for ESDs that was developed, I believe, in the 1990s that came out of that commission that Dr. Casey mentioned. And it's kind of guidelines, and one was at least 10,000 student count, at least one institution of higher education within the district, and there is some distance criterion, but I don't remember what that was. But there is some language in the statute and administrative rule that addresses the question of how big is big enough. I just wanted to call that to your attention. And Representative, did I answer your question good enough? Is that what satisfactory?
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have a couple of questions, but now something you just said, Bob, has provoked another one, and that's this criterion of having an institution of higher education. Was that just was that sort of the politics to avoid certain consolidations? I mean, what was the motivation for that?
Representative Dimbrough, I believe it was to look at an education system, you know, pre-K through higher education, to encourage cooperation and collaboration among the entities. And I believe that was the motivation for it.
Okay.
That's my understanding anyway.
So is that a reason that Willamette was able to consolidate in the way that it has? Is that related?
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbrough, it was not a requirement at the time, so it did not enter into our decision to merge.
Okay, thank you. Going back, Dr. Casey, to your experience with the merger or consolidation, how quickly did that happen? What was the timeline for that? And I'm wondering if that's also a way perhaps to address the workforce aspects. Is this something that happened very, very quickly, or did it happen over time?
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbrough, that's a good question. I'm trying to taxes my memory. I believe it takes about a full year. There is a timeline that must be followed, and so if it's done by, I believe, May 31st, then it goes into effect. You have to do a study. You have to collect the maps. You have to go through the State Board of Education with the recommendation. They have to approve it. Both boards, if you're in each of the ESDs, need to concur and meet, and so there is an established process, but it would take 1 to 2 years.
Chair Gilster, Representative Dimbrough, in our case in Northwest Regional, with the four coming together, the 93 session legislated it, and then we had until, as Marie saying, the May date in 95. And so it was a couple of years to get those four organizations to come together. It's quite a task to do that. But within the, and I was at the ESD then. I later left for 8 years to a school district, but merging them together was quite a task, but in a two-year period, it was comfortable doing it.
Okay, thank you. And then I had one other question, and that's, you're going to talk about the new governance model, right, the pilot projects, because I'm wondering to what extent your experience at Willamette was helped by that new governance model, if that, you know, may have helped lead to the smoothness of that transition.
Madam Chair, Representative Dembro, in our particular situation, we already had board members who were affiliated with Chemeketa Community College, so we had that higher ed affiliation. When the pilot governance model has five board members elected by your component districts, and then they in turn appoint four, and the four have to represent higher ed, social services, business, and one at large. So I will say that the transition to the new board, we had five board members come back, so that provided some stability and continuity, and then the additional board members that were appointed, we already had higher ed. We were able to get a director of Head Start, and because we are a major provider of early childhood services, that really strengthened it. But so it wasn't it didn't necessarily change the way we were doing business, because we had representatives from some of those areas before, but the fact that they are appointed to represent that particular constituent has resulted in some good interactions and some pursuit of additional opportunities for collaborative partnerships.
Thank you.
Further questions? Go on. Thank you.
Okay, I'll just touch on the pilot ESDs a little bit. Maureen just mentioned probably the crux of it, and that is the legislature in 05 wanted to see what would happen if ESD board members were elected directly by school district boards. And so that's the five that Maureen's talking about. So the three of us zoned into five zones, then those boards vote for those board members. And then those five in turn appoint the four that Maureen spoke of. And I would just say that I agree with what Maureen said in terms of the benefits. The primary benefit we saw is not a different way that our ESD operates, but it's the partnerships that opened up for us with having those folks on our board were heightened. I don't think there's any question about that. And that's been very helpful to us. And so that transition is well behind us. And so we're operating that way, and we'll continue to operate that way, we hope. I wanted to mention state funding for ESDs. There's a lot of confusion out there as to how that all works, and quite frankly, there's many school district superintendents who are unclear from time to time on how that works, because it is fairly complicated. But ESDs receive 4.75% of the K-12 appropriation. And so when that money goes to ESDs, then it's divided amongst the ESDs similarly. There's some complexity here I won't get into, but similarly to the how school district money is divided, and so I'll just basically say enrollment generated within a particular region, and then once those dollars are allocated to a particular ESD like our ESD, we know that 10% of that can be retained to operate the organization. The other 90% is to go directly to programs and services. And if you couple that with what Maureen mentioned earlier regarding the local service plan, which is the plan we put together to see how that 90% is going to happen, we bring our superintendents together, and I think almost all ESDs do that. I'll speak just to mine specifically. Every October, we bring all 20 of our superintendents together in our region, our school district superintendents, and we come forward with a draft plan, and they add to it, subtract from it, we work through it, we massage it, and we come to a plan that everyone can agree with. Now, you might think that's somewhat difficult, given that our largest district is Beaverton, with just under 40,000 kids, and our smallest district is Jewell, with just under 200 kids. Very different needs, very different priorities. But what happens is when you have school districts wanting to work together, you come up with a plan that meets the large and meets the small, and that's what we do. And the last 4 or 5 years, we've had a unanimous agreement amongst those superintendents. And then what we do is we go back and take that plan as a draft to our board. So our board of directors, and this is how it works in every ESD, the board approves a plan. That plan then, from whenever you approve that, for us it's normally December, so December through March 1st, every board, school board in our region votes on that plan, up or down. And if you get two-thirds of your school districts voting for it, representing over 50% of the kids in your region, then your plan has passed. If you don't meet either one of those thresholds, it's back to the drawing board and massage it again and figure out how you can get there. Fortunately, the majority of the ESDs in the state normally get their plan done and passed by March 1st, and then you're ready to implement that plan. So that's the way that process works, and it works that same way for every ESD. As Maureen said, I think that's a pretty strong accountability system built in to the statute, and I think that's it's a wise accountability system. We don't get our ESD plan moving forward unless our school districts agree that's the right plan for them. In terms of the local service plan, I just decided to give you a copy of the plan that we use. And with that plan, that's our roadmap for implementing our services. And you can see that plan is divided up into the four major areas that Maureen talked about that were highlighted in House Bill 3184, and that's those administrative support services. I want to talk about those a little bit. What that is different for every ESD, but for the most part, generally speaking, the administration at the ESD is there to assist the administration in those school districts in a whole number of ways. We serve as the liaison between the Department of Education and our districts. And I will tell you, when these days, with the cuts in the Department of Education's budget, I'll tell you over the last several years, what happens is, and Maureen would say the same thing, when one of our districts has a question about something that's happening in the state, they call us. Because they know that we are staying in tune. Maureen and I and others at OAESD, we have periodic conference calls with Ed Dennis, the Deputy Superintendent of ODE, and others, so that we know what's happening and we can give feedback on what's going on in, with the state, and truly partner with them so we can partner with our districts on a statewide basis. So that's part of what happens with administrative support. There's other things that happen there too. When in our district, one of our districts runs into some trouble and needs us to help them with their fiscal office, we do that. They need some help with HR, we do that. Our largest department, and this is true of most ESDs, is Special Student Services. You heard Maureen say that's one of the primary reasons ESDs were put together in the first place. And there are those children that school districts economically just cannot afford to have every school district have their own special program for every type of disability that exists out there. And so we're able to come forward and say, all right, we can put together consortium programs that districts can utilize, and it doesn't cost them near as much as it would, not even close to how much it would individually. And let me give you just one quick easy example for that. Let's say you have a small district like Gaston in my region that needs a speech language therapist. Well, that is going to cost them a good amount of money if they had to go out and find one, because it's hard to just go out and find a speech-language therapist for half a day a week. But what we do is we have a lot of them. And so we're able to say we can take the 0.2 of this person over here, we can put another 0.6 over here for a little larger district, we can put another 0.2 over here. We have a full-time person employed but working within three different school districts and providing that service. So there's an economy of scale on virtually everything we do. And if there isn't, what we always say is districts should be doing it themselves. But we do provide an economy of scale.
Can I ask you a question about that piece? There was an article that ran in the Statesman Journal today that talked about the Oregon School for the Blind, and I assume that services for students who are blind is part of the portfolio of the Educational Service District. And I was talking about not students who are not able to have those needs met by their ESDs and local school districts at a cost of upwards of $160,000 per student per year. What kinds of services are you able to offer through your ESDs to school districts that might have a blind student who is enrolling? And is there something that we could do to better support ESDs and regional programs so that we could use those same dollars to deliver them to students in home communities rather than having such a large expense in a centralized residential facility without a K-12 curriculum in it?
Representative Gelser and members of the committee, Maureen can answer this as well, but we do have a vision department within our special student services, within our ESD, and we have quite a few youngsters who are either totally blind or have a vision impairment of some sort. And so we provide services for each of those children within our region. And again, it's a spectrum of what those services would be depending on what their vision impairment is. But we provide those services, and Maureen, I'm sure, will say the same thing.
Madam Chair, there are approximately 950 students currently who are blind and visually impaired throughout the state that are receiving services from regional programs, and those services not only include a teacher of the visually impaired, but an orientation mobility specialist who teaches them how to travel or assist them in becoming independent travelers in the community, and adaptive materials. The ESDs have equipment loaning banks that loan Braille and mobility equipment to the students. Willamette ESD happens to operate the State Oregon Textbook and Media Center, and we're responsible for seeing that every single book, textbook that a public school uses in Oregon that needs to be brailled gets brailled and to the students. So those services are being provided in the local communities.
Thank you. Are there other questions at this point?
So if I can add just a couple of more things. I mentioned administrative services, special student services, and again, that includes early intervention, early childhood special education, the regional programs we've been talking about. But then we have school improvement services. We partner with our local school districts to help them with database, research-based school improvement strategies. And over the last couple of years, ESDs have led the effort throughout the entire state of Oregon, where we have one model that we're working off of that school districts are utilizing, and we have training going on all over the state. And so with our school improvement, it's gone a long ways from where it was a few years ago, where you'd call what some of our staff call the kind of the helicopter drops you. You come in, do a quick training, and get out. Very different now. We're partnering with our school districts on their school improvement plans. So that's a big part of what we do. And the fourth area is technology services. Many people don't realize this because it's behind the scenes, but ESDs in this state provide the financial systems, HR systems for our school districts that they really can't do without. The student information services, if you can think of a student record, we have it on our systems in a very confidential way, but school districts can access that information. They put that data in, and then they have that access through that system that there's no way they could afford individually. And then, of course, internet, email, etc. So a large array of services within technology, and again, those vary by ESD around the state somewhat, but the staples that I mentioned are there. And so I guess I want to just end my comments by stating that, as Bob mentioned, we have 20 ESDs, and they range in size just like the 20 districts within my region do. Very small ESDs to ours in Northwest, which is the largest. And so it's going to vary on the kinds of services, the capacity issues that Marie mentioned earlier. So it's going to vary around the state. But those ESDs, by House Bill 3184, have the absolute responsibility to provide services to their school districts within those four areas that we mentioned. I wish we could talk about, you know, all the amazing commonalities that happen, but the reason we can't do that is because every community is different, every school district is different, every area has their own individual needs, and I know that there might be a year when our superintendents come to our ESD and say, we need this particular service, we want to form a legal consortium, let's say, and save money on attorney's fees, whereas the superintendents in Marine's ESD might have a totally different need, but we're there to put it together and make it happen and make it work so it's economically sound and the high quality remains. I think that's what ESDs are all about.
Thank you. Other Representative Umbro.
Thank you. And, you know, we were discussing earlier the savings that happened as a result of consolidation. It would really be useful, I think, to see some figures on that. I don't know if you can provide that, but I would be very interested in that. And I'm also wondering about, and maybe I missed this in the discussion of the budget process, but the budget is ultimately approved in a public meeting of the board. Is that right? And presumably, there's a chance for intervention at that point if there are some disagreements. And then is there also a subsequent review by, I know in Multnomah County, we have the Multnomah County Tax and Something Supervisory Commission that looks at the different adopted budgets or approved budgets anyway. And is there a similar kind of mechanism in place?
Representative Gelser, Representative Dembro, I'll speak to your second question first. I mentioned those 8 years I went away from the ESD. Well, during that time, I was a superintendent of Multnomah County and was under the TSCC, and Multnomah County is the only county in Oregon that has that requirement, because of the population in Multnomah County. I believe the statute has it at a certain population. I may be wrong about that, but I think that's what it is. For instance, in our four counties, we don't have an organization like that. But what we do have is, and I should have mentioned this earlier, and I thank you for mentioning it, like every other school district, the 197 school districts in the state of Oregon, once that local service plan is approved by the school boards, we then present a budget to our budget committee like everyone else, no different. And we have those same public postings, we have those same public meetings, we have those same questions. The interesting note about our budget committees, though, for the most part, and it's not the same everywhere, but for the most part, ESDs normally have the other half of their budget committee that's not their board. The other half is normally school board members from the school boards, the school districts that you serve. There are some differences around the state, but that's primarily the model. It certainly is in our ESD, and so we have our 9 board members, and we have therefore 13 budget committee members, and the other 9 are school board members from around our 20 districts. And so, yes, we have the same process. We get great questions because the difference I see as an ESD superintendent versus as a school district superintendent, when I was a school district superintendent, many times the folks coming onto the budget committee are just getting involved in what's happening with the schools in their district, and sometimes don't really have the knowledge that they might have ordinarily. Many times they go on and become board members and they gain all of that. In our situation, though, we have our 9 board members, and here come 9 board members, veteran board members from school districts. They know how this works, and we get some great, great questions from those board members. And, of course, yes, they've got to approve that budget, and then it is adopted by our board.
Thanks a lot.
Any further questions? Representative Van Orman?
Well, I would thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to say that I was around before we really got into ESDs doing early childhood, and it was a nightmare because we couldn't get the speech therapist because, Maupin is 65 miles from the Dalles, and you only need them for a special time. So
that's right.
I really understand what they're talking about, and I want to put in a plug that when you're talking about those counties on the other side of the mountain, you cannot ignore the distance.
Further comments or questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was easy.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have one more question that just popped into my mind as I was thinking about the distance, and I don't know if it's pertinent for you folks or not, but I'm really curious as to how technology and distance learning might help address some of those needs in a cost-effective manner. I see there's an answer here that says not very effective. So
we're talking special needs. We're talking children who are severely disabled, need speech therapy. You're talking about behavior management issues. I would love that would solve it, Chris, but I'm sorry. It was not my place to answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Harkin, there are some specific areas where it does make a difference in terms of distance ed. And one great example is Southern Oregon ESD offers online classes. And they're currently providing Spanish classes to 8 districts who could not find Spanish teachers. They couldn't provide their own. So the ESD has a Spanish teacher and is meeting the needs of those 8 districts. And they are so creative. Again, this goes back to the ESDs do what their districts need. Southern Oregon ESD just submitted a grant to Homeland Security to offer an online Chinese class for their districts. And that's the kind of entrepreneurship that goes on with ESDs. We're currently the largest provider of driver ed. 8 years ago, we didn't provide driver's ed. Salem Kaiser came to us and said, we're providing driver's education. It's diverting us from our mission, which is academic achievement and getting kids to standards. And quite frankly, it doesn't pay for itself. We're subsidizing it. Would you please take it on for us? The minute we took it over for Salem Kaiser, other districts started saying, hey, we don't want to have staff taking up their time for driver ed, and yet our parents really need it. It's good for the community because of the safety issue. It's good for parents because it reduces their insurance. ESD, here's a service that we would like you to take on for us. And that's what ESDs do. When it comes to technology, technology is the greatest equalizer that we know. There are more savings to be made if districts and ESDs collaborate with technology. ESDs host email services for districts. They provide the internet connectivity, and because of the economy of scale, they can do it more cost effectively than each individual district going out and providing it on your own. So you've really hit on an area that there could be a significant amount of savings. There's only 6 data warehouses in the state. We saved hundreds of thousands of dollars by having a couple of the ESDs, or 4 districts who have data warehouses essentially for themselves, and a couple of ESDs that opened up the data warehouses, and those districts didn't spend their own money on programming to set up their own. They pulled in with the ESDs who were taking other districts and saved literally hundreds of thousands of dollars because they shared that programming time and offered it to not only the districts in their region but outside their region who needed the help. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, good one. Thank you. Yeah.
I think you liked that question.
Just a quick follow-up. And those savings that were realized and that perhaps more can be realized, are those to be realized in the core budget, the 25% of the... Where in the budget will we see those?
Representative Gelsa, Representative Harker, that local service plan you have in front of you is just mine. Mm-hmm. It doesn't represent all ESD mm-hmm. local service plans. Ours just happens to be we take that 90% and we divide it into that 25% and that 75%. But the bottom line is what happens when we do what Maureen just talked about, mm-hmm. the savings is going to be primarily district money. Districts are going to be able to save money because what they do is, in addition to everything we already offer, they come to us with some idea and say, are you willing to broker this for us to form this consortium? And that's outside of ESD funding. What we do is we put something together for them, and they're able then to pay for it in a consortium rather than individual districts, and they save money in their general fund.
Okay. School districts, when you're saying districts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. School districts, right.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yep.
Welcome. Representative Van Orman.
No, Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just following up on what they were saying. So it's really motivated by the school districts who perceive a need, and then you work together with the school districts and, as you said, broker a deal.
Representative Gelser, Representative Van Orman, yes, but we also believe that ESDs have a responsibility to think outside the box and bring ideas. And so every October with our superintendents, for instance, we'll bring them 10 or 15 ideas. They might accept two of them, but we bring them as many ideas as we can to show how we can do things regionally and have that economy of scale.
Okay.
Thank you all very much for sharing your time today and great information. And we're going to move on to an overview of community colleges and workforce development. Commissioner Camille Preyas, please. Sorry. Welcome. Thank you for coming this afternoon.
Good afternoon. For the record, Camille Preuss, the director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development and the commissioner for community colleges. I have a couple pieces of information that are coming around. I wanted to begin by just hitting some high points about community colleges, and then I'll concentrate on those handouts. I do appreciate the invitation to come and share as I look around the dais. You likely know more about your own individual college than I do. That always puts me at a slight disadvantage. But as I talk to the college, community college boards around the state, which I try to get around to every board at least once a year, my approach is that I try to give them information about the whole of the 17, because I believe they probably know their local college better than I do. So let's just start with the role of community colleges, and apologize if this is redundant to what you already know, which is probably true. Collectively, the 17 community colleges in Oregon really provide the majority of the workforce training in the state. They make sure that the programs that are offered meet the labor market demands of that area and of the state. Following on your conversation about ESDs, we also look for places where a collective response is at least as effective as individual responses. There is also training that for certain that is past high school and less than a baccalaureate. We've had some information earlier this session around the educational attainment goal of 40-40-20. You know, when you think about community colleges, think about them as that middle 40. And the middle 40 are also those jobs that require more than a high school diploma but may not include a bachelor's degree. And that's over 50% of the jobs in Oregon. They include technical and craft jobs like welders, and pilots, EMTs, nurses, just to name a few. The beauty of the community college is that whenever and wherever someone comes to the community college in quest for education or a career, is that the community college takes them where they are to that next level. Even if they have a bachelor's or a master's and they need some particular certification, that's available at the community college. We provide opportunities for dual credit and exposure to college while an individual is still in high school. It provides a leg up for students, and it saves time and money. At Portland Community College, more than 120,000 credits were awarded last year to high school students. Think about that. Think about the savings of that. Transfer. We have worked long and hard the last decade to align and articulate the community college curriculum to the four-year institutions, both public and private. You probably know of the dual degree program at Lynn Benton Community College, where there is one application for financial aid, one application to the both institutions, and the students there have a very seamless articulation between the community college and the university system. Transfer makes up about 41% of the work of the program enrollment at community colleges. Let's talk a little about career and technical programs that make up that middle 40 I was talking about earlier. That's about 32% of the enrollment at community colleges. In the last, in September of 2007, when the with the budget that passed in the 07 session to today, we have added 66 new professional technical programs. And again, remembering that every single one of them had to be tied to a local labor market need, or public resources can't follow for it to fund that program. Language acquisition is an important aspect of what community colleges do. And you can't really take a solid career step forward if you don't have operating and useful knowledge of English. And then there's adult basic ed, GED, and bridge classes that are provided to students so that they have the skills they need. Our economy really requires that we not leave anyone behind, and so language acquisition at the through the community college is an important aspect. We also use community colleges to reconnect adults who have, for one reason or another, either only have a high school diploma or who lack a high school diploma. There are nearly 400,000 Oregonians who do not have a high school diploma, and those low literacy skills stand in their way of acquiring collegiate credit and the skills for our expanding economy. I shouldn't say that today. It's really not expanding. When it does expand, we want to be ready. The folks that need that skill up before they can enter collegiate programs through basic literacy skills, over half of them have less than an eighth grade education. And it takes a good year of intensive work to raise that education level to a level where an individual can actually benefit from collegiate training. And that's about 25% of the community college population. A little more about bridge programs. I'm not sure if that's new terminology to you or not, but we actually have bridge programs, and it's not about building a bridge. It's figuratively about making sure that the ramp exists for individuals who have low skills and can move into collegiate level work. We also now have pre-bridge, so even less literacy skills programs, because what we have learned, what the research shows, is that students who have low literacy skills, whether they are English language learners or not, they learn best in a context, or an applied, usually in a occupationally applied way. So we have worked with the community colleges across the state to build both manufacturing and healthcare pre-bridge and bridge, which helps the individual that's in class not think this is an esoteric skill that reading and writing and math is, but that it has application in their real life. Can't ignore the workforce development programs that community colleges offer, whether it's temporary aid for needy families, otherwise they used to be known as welfare recipients, or dislocated workers. Community colleges have a proud history of reaching out and building programs with locally or federally funded programs to ensure that individuals have access to the highest quality training available. And then there's non-credit, from one class to high-end certifications. It could be Cisco or other very specific skills in health, safety, or workforce. Your community college offers those as well. Two more, small business development centers. 13 of the community colleges have small business development centers on their campus and outreach to small businesses. I don't think I have to remind this dais that Oregon is a small business state, and for there are currently performance measures in the department's set of key performance measures that look at the number of small business plans that are developed and brought to fruition. And then there's customized training, and that's the training that is specific for an employer or a consortia of employers. And you might think of Vestas, perhaps could have started that way. Certainly Solar World in Hillsboro started that way, wanting a very specific piece of training to get local individuals trained to go to work in that particular field. and it's usually non-credit, very customized. But then what the college will do, whether it's Columbia Gorge or Portland or either Tillamook Bay, will take that non-credit and move it through the process to make it a credit-bearing course and make it either a one-year certificate or a two-year degree. So let's talk a little bit about the budget picture, and I'm going to move to this particular handout. As I said, I make a trip around to all 17 community colleges, community college local boards, and this is a handout that I have used for probably the last 3 or 4 biennia. It gives a snapshot of where we are with a fairly high level, but you can see that if you have your reading glasses on, that in 2007-08, community college enrollment was up about 3.5% across the state to 380,000. We're still shy of where we were in 2001. There we were about 406,000 students. Our full-time enrollments are also, the trend line is encouraging. It's up to about 94,000. Still not the 102 that we were at the high point, but it is trending in the right direction. Our fall enrollment for community colleges was 10.5% statewide. Winter term, which started 1st of January, is also up about 5%. So we expect fall to be the gold standard, if you will, for enrollment. Would expect that winter term we would come down some. But I think what you're seeing is
I think Representative Springer has a question.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
If I could stop you for just a moment. I noticed your peak before we leave here, 2000. Thank you, Madam Chair. 2001, 2002, it's a steady incline, which looks great, and a pretty steep drop. Would you expand on that a little bit?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, it would be the loss of about $70 million out of the Community College Support Fund over a period. Yeah, when we get to the inside flap, you'll see
tunnel vision.
That's okay. You gave me the opportunity.
You can thank me later. Walked right into that.
Thank you. I don't want to miss the opportunity, though, to talk about the role of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the need-based financial aid that's available now in 2008-09 for the first time for part-time students, and the reworking that I'm sure you all are aware of in the 07 session around a shared responsibility model that has become the new Oregon Opportunity Grant has enabled Oregon's community college students to have far greater access to the opportunity grant. We've also seen tuition moderate over the last several years, and we think that that has something to do with the increase in enrollment. If we turn to the inside, we look about what, and you look at what's happened to funding. The bar charts there give you a pretty graphic picture of what happened in between 2001 and 2003. Five special sessions were not kind to community colleges, certainly like most other state services, took quite a reduction. The first bar graph is the overall appropriation, and the second is the state support per student. So you can see that that really did lose ground on over $500 per student in a period of about 2 years. It has been steadily increasing, and we're pleased for that. If you look at the bottom of page 2, when you think about how community colleges are funded, it's a mixture of three major resources. And the reason this graph goes back so far to 1991 is because of Measure 5. And it's just important for, I think, everyone to again acknowledge that unlike K-12, community colleges are not we're not constitutionally protected by Measure 5. Now, I recognize that that protection for K-12 did not provide for inflation, but we neither had that protection nor did we have inflation. And you can see that the state support and tuition have made up the difference in the loss of property taxes. So we went from approximately 50% local support to approximately today a little somewhere in the middle 40s support for state funds to operate community colleges. And again, if you looked at 2001 and 3, you see that tuition made up the difference as state support lagged, but students were still coming to community college. They were just paying more. In a five-year period of time, tuition almost doubled in this state. When I started in 2000, late 99-2000, across the state, the average was $32 a credit, and you could go to community colleges in some places in the state for under 30, 28 was not unreasonable. The average now is 65 and likely will be 70 by next fall. If you also looked at what does it mean for, I've already hit on some of the tuition and state support and the difference there, and that's on page 3. One of the reductions that happened during the third special session, I'm pretty sure, in 2002 and 3, was a reduction of adult continuing ed that was reimbursed by the state. That was about 10% of the headcount. It was never a very high percentage of reimbursables within the community college system, but if I were to have President Carnahan sitting next to me from Tillamook Bay Community College, well over 50% of the business that they did in Tillamook County was adult continuing ed. Everything from enrichment courses to health and safety and workforce. But when it was decided that those enrichment courses could no longer be reimbursed, Tillamook Bay lost a huge proportion of their enrollment, because now those courses, you have to make them pay. You have to pay what it costs to actually offer the course, unless it is health, safety, or workforce related. So when you look at the course sections offered statewide and you see that plunge, some of that is indicative of the loss of adult continuing ed and its reimbursability. But we also had huge shrinkage because of that $70 million loss. So what does that mean for educational attainment and arriving or actually attaining 40-40-20? The graph at the bottom of page 3 gives you a snapshot of where Oregon is. The first bar is where the U.S. is, where Oregon is, and our goals. And when you look at that 33%, that pale blue 33%, you might think that we're pretty close to 40. But the way in which that data is gathered, both here and across the U.S., is that's some college. That's not a certificate or a degree or a professional certification like an apprenticeship. It includes those. But it also includes perhaps a 6-credit course in flagger training, or the credential that you need to have now to serve alcohol. So when the population survey is done every other year and Oregonians are asked, have you had some college, it runs a very wide gamut. So I say that only so that what I recognize is that if we're looking at the number of individuals who have an associate or professional credential, it drops to something under 22% in the state. So we still have room to grow to meet that 40% of the middle 40. The last page is all about capital construction. The governor's budget for the 09 session has $15.9 million in it for three projects. These are the three colleges who have yet to receive Article 11G matching funds from the state. The other 14 have. You will find them in the last paragraph on this page. Treasure Valley, Blue Mountain, and Umpqua are the three that are in line for capital construction this session. And then the last page, one of the questions asked was, what's the department's legislative agenda? And it's all around the governor's recommended budget. It includes the resources for the Community College Support Fund. We've spent some time looking at what that support has looked like in the past. It's at $485 million with an additional $15.2 million in general fund from the Education Stability Fund in the 2010 plan for the 2010 supplemental session. Capital construction I've just covered. Oregon Career Readiness Certificate. This is a way to certificate the skills of individuals regardless of their age, and a way for employers to know that when an individual comes to them, if they have the certificate, they would know what their applied math, reading, and locating information skill set was. We have a wonderful partnership there with the business organizations in the state. And we would like to take it from a pilot phase or demonstration phase to a full state rollout. Career and technical education. I didn't spend much time on that today, but there are always innovative and entrepreneurial programs in the career and technical area that we would like to launch, particularly these days around green, clean, sustainable, renewable. Those course offerings and programs right now reside in four community colleges. Wind at Columbia Gorge, sustainable renewable at Lane, PCC has solar, as well as Chemeketa, and Lynn Benton is also on the way up with solar. But what we would love to be able to do is take that statewide. This investment is to not just do clean and green, but also continue expansion of innovative ways to deliver healthcare training, as well as manufacturing. And I feel like I'm just talking my you to death.
Very good information. Thank you.
Madam
Chair. Yes, Representative Maurer.
I have several questions. May I?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Regarding the district taxes and every community college receives, maybe not everyone, but most receive some local support through either counties or, and it varies significantly. But in the distribution formula, the districts that provide local funds are penalized for those local funds because those are subtracted from that distribution formula. And Royal Community College, Josephine County, and a lot of other areas doesn't support things, but an area communications have high level support. And so the question is, why should Josephine County continue to tax its citizens locally when they're being penalized in a distribution formula on a state basis? Seems to me they would get rid of their local tax because they're essentially going to get the same amount from the state because the state would make it up based on the distribution formula.
Chair Gessler and Representative Maurer, yes, in order to belong to a community college district, local voters would have had to have voted to tax themselves to support, through property taxes, to support their community college. With the passage of Measure 5, 47, and 50, the cap of $5 for all of education means that no voters no longer have the opportunity to particularly raise their property taxes if they wanted something more, unless it's a bond levy for construction, but certainly not for operating. And yes, it is true that when I think it was Measure 47 and 50 passed, there was a designation of what that taxing level would be. And the legislature did that, not the people. The people said, yes, we want to pay this amount for the support. Measure 47 and 50 instituted what that level would be. And so in Oregon, community college support goes from 16 cents a thousand to $1.66 a thousand. If you're in Treasure Valley, you pay $1.66. If you're in Mount Hood, you pay $1.22 in Treasure Valley, $0.66 in Blue Mountain, which is Morrow, New Matilla, and Portland has the lowest rate. You are also correct that when the state looks at the support per student for community colleges, they add, it is additive. They add local property tax and the state support. Previous to this, we had community colleges that had well over $4,000 in support for a student and others who had $2,500, and there was really no way to equalize. Community colleges were late to the game of equalization, and we have a policy in place, board policy by the State Board of Education, to use a six-year window to move from a non-equalized rate, where I gave you the example of the difference between students, to an equalized rate. And the determination of the board is we should not penalize a student because of where they live in the state around the quality of the education they receive. And recognizing that six-year window is in enabling colleges to prepare for this change. The board policy is that both property tax and state support are public resources, and they are part and parcel of the same.
Follow up, if I may.
Of course.
So why would Josephine County continue to pay a disproportionate amount of their funding for them? Is there anything prohibiting them from the same, we're going to reduce our tax base?
Chair Gessler and Representative Maurer, not that I am aware of. If there are counties in the state that are not part of a college district and do not pay local property taxes toward that effort, the state still provides at least minimal services to those areas, and this is primarily the frontier parts of Oregon, if I can say it that way. And a college, if you were to look at Harney County, they do not pay local property taxes, but there's still what is called a contract out of district for services to Harney County provided by Treasure Valley or I think it is Treasure Valley. So yes, they could decide not to pay at all, but then I would imagine that the level of support that they got would be different. I mean, if they paid nothing, but if they chose to take it to a vote of the people to reduce it, I know of nothing that would stand in their way of that at this moment, anyway.
Any further follow-up?
No, it's just an issue in our district. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back decades ago, of course, before the funding form occurred, I'm certainly not trying to...
Oh.
But it's an issue, and we have difficulty passing tax levies in Josephine County. But this one they support long decades ago, and now we're as a community being penalized based on that funding formula. And so it has come up in multiple conversations about why would Rogue continue, or why would Josephine County continue with this tax levy, because there's no penalty to just say we're not going to pay anymore. And, you know, I mean, overall, the budget, the whole state is going to be affected. And I'm not suggesting they do it. It just, when you are struggling to keep, you know, public safety, then sometimes those conversations come up.
And I think that's a discussion that plays out across equalization across the state, generally, certainly.
Right, K-12
as well. Yeah. Our school district, which had one of the highest tax rates in the state for supporting local schools, continues to do that and becomes a donor district to school districts in other parts of the state, continuing to pay that tax. Representative Wilburn?
Yeah, that was really the point I was going to make, is that they also, you have to look at the total tax rate, because that's what 47 and 50 did, and
right,
their total tax burden with respect to all those state services may be less than a whole lot of other districts. They may not even be to their $5
right
maximum, because when we stuck in 50 and 47, we also made places that said they can only, the maximum they can raise because of those limits is so much. So you have places like Curry that have a maximum of $1.87. I mean, that's all they can raise for part of the taxes. Even though it said they could do five because of things that were already there, they aren't able to. So it's a 47 and 50 created a lot of anomalies with respect to equalization.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, I might add to that that, you know, again, all of this flowed from the decision that we would equalize per student funding at the community college level in the same way that that was done for K-12. And once that decision was made, then a process was set up to figure out a way to get to that point in a manner that would have as little of a negative impact as possible on individual districts. And it was a long process. I know that because I was part of it. And a counterpart from Rogue Community College was also part of that. And so everyone had skin in the game and everyone had a voice in the direction that we went.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think you weren't quite done with, you had a few more bullet points and then we can do more questions.
Well, thank you, Chair Gesler. I was pretty close to finished. I did want the committee to know that it's not just the budget that we're watching and have interest in. So the back page has other interests. I'm leading a lively conversation around the federal stimulus. There remains in both both state and both Senate and House versions nearly a doubling of federal workforce dollars that would come to the state, and the workforce development part of the department administers those funds. So we have been talking about how would one state receive about $15 million and have less than 30 days to get them into contract so that more than 1,000 youth could be employed this summer. So you can imagine we're running really fast to get a good handle on that. We've also done deferred maintenance and looking at shovel-ready jobs, looking at who is currently unemployed in Oregon, what skills do they have, how can we match those skills with the federal stimulus dollars, whether it's weatherization, whether it's Department of Transportation, whether it's green energy, whatever it is. We actually have a very robust database in the state that will tell us what almost 250,000 Oregonians are registered there and will tell us what there's now. We can begin to sort it by what skill level do they have and how might we match them up with the dollars that are coming. Just a fine point on that. We asked the question about construction trades. How many individuals have some experience, either whether they're employed or they're drawing unemployment insurance? There are over 130,000 Oregonians that have at least a month's experience in the construction trades. So we said, well, how many from a month to 6 months, 6 months to a year, 1 year to 5 years, 5 years and beyond? That 130,000 number doesn't shrink a lot until you get past 5 years. Hmm. There are a lot of people that have what I would consider reasonable experience in construction trades. About 70,000 of them are not connected at all to either a labor hall or an employer. So they're actively seeking either better employment, more employment. They might be part-time. But we now know where they are, and we know what region of the state they are in. So just last week, Department Director Lori Warner and I met with Housing and Community Services and with ODOT to say, we know this about people all across the state. Let's partner to make sure that Oregonians get the first step up when federal stimulus and now state stimulus, deferred maintenance, resources come to the state. So I just wanted you to know that in the workforce development side, we're doing quite a lot of work to marry together the information that we know about those that are unemployed so that they have the best opportunity to receive their a job that will hopefully bring them to more full-time employment. And with that, I would be happy to answer any other questions.
Are there further questions for Commissioner Boyce?
Excellent.
Representative Huffman.
Maybe one. Thank you, Madam Chair. On the federal stimulus dollars, do we have, of course, differences between the packages, but do we have a decent idea of what might be coming to the state and the types of strings that are going to be attached to them so that you kind of have a guide for where we can slot the different dollars? Or are you getting kind of a clearer picture of that as each day passes?
Chair Gessler and Representative Huffman, for the federal workforce training, there's slightly more money in the House version, slightly less in the Senate version, but it would be anywhere between $30 and $40 million to the state. The my example of the summer youth program, that's the one that we know the most about. It hasn't been something that the Department of Labor, Federal Department of Labor, has funded for in any real way for almost a decade. So we're expecting that will be very targeted, about $17 or $18 million approximately, will be for dislocated workers, those people who have lost their job through layoff or plant closure, and then the rest for adults, which is just individuals who are disadvantaged, economically disadvantaged. Then there are all kinds of resources for green jobs initiatives. There's some competitive grants for high wage, high demand areas, including healthcare and, again, green technology. Those are a little more squishy dollar amount wise. Then there was deferred maintenance and stabilization dollars for both K-12 and post-secondary education in both bills. So we're tracking them, even though they move around a little. We don't really, I personally don't yet know what's the level of strings, except for that particular fund that I currently administer. And trust me, I have routine conversations with the Department of Labor to keep those funds as flexible as they possibly can so that we can put them to the absolute best use once they come to the state.
Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Something that's become interesting to all of us lately has been how we can best integrate returning veterans back into the community. And I would imagine that the community colleges are going to be really vital in that process. I'm wondering what's going on that you know of at the different colleges, and how, and I know this can be kind of tricky, but how their experience in the military, their training in the military, is being translated perhaps into getting a leg up in some programs, getting some credit for that experience, and how we can take advantage of that to get more skilled tradespeople out there.
Chair Gelzer and Representative Dimbrough, that's a big question. We have done surveys of the colleges to see who has tuition waivers and what's the extent of those tuition waivers for returning veterans or those who return disabled, 100% disabled. Also, there's a real effort through the governor's office, an executive order that was signed about a week ago, to really ramp up veteran services and the connecting what is a host of programs that are provided for returning veterans into one more manageable. Veterans Affairs has launched a website for, I won't say all things of veteran concern, but certainly a way to bring them all together so there isn't a mismatch of information. And CCWD did participate on the task force that helped bring forward consolidation of information that's available for veterans, whether it's through workforce development at the college level or federally sponsored. The how to transition skills to credit. All the community colleges have programs that will look at what the skills are an individual has and translate them through a credit for proficiency process into credit that is available at the college. It is one process. I do know that there are in other parts of the nation broader efforts to really transition degrees or certificates. I think it is the Air Force that actually has almost its own community college, and the transcripting there of those credits into a community college and the acceptance of those is pretty slick. But I think that is only for that particular armed service. It doesn't expand through Army, Navy, Marines. So right now it is a process of taking the skill, matching it up with credit and program that is offered at the community college, and then transcripting the skill. It could be simpler, I would warrant. It yeah. needs an eye to that detail.
Yeah, if I could just follow up just on that point, thanks. Do you know, Cam, are there conversations happening at the national level about improving the conversations, you know, between the military branches and the world of education? Because, I have a sense that, you know, among the many silos that are out there, that those are silos that are pretty impregnable at the moment. You know, is that true?
Chair Gelzer, Representative Dimbro, I don't have an idea, but I can find out and get that answer back to you. I don't have a response to that question.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair Gelzer. I guess it'll end in a question, but I want to make some statements first. Because this community college is an important part, I think, that most people don't understand the scope of the mission. And from my perspective as a high school principal, it's the place where we can help people who chose not to be successful a lot of times in high schools reenter into a workforce. It's a place for our most gifted students in rural areas to do the 2+2 programs or other kinds of programs and take directly college courses. It's a place where people can come out of the workforce at any time in their lives and reenter into the education system and move forward. And you mentioned it just in passing. I think we disenfranchised the whole population that we used to actively participate in our community college life. And that had to do when we changed the definition of what courses could be counted for the actual student per diem. And so, speaking for the community colleges that I've been associated with in Southern Oregon, we used to have this really vibrant community of senior citizens and others who came to our college campuses and traditionally voted for whatever the college wanted because they knew how important it was in their individual lives, and they knew that part of them going also actually contributed to the health of the whole school because they didn't always need all of the per diem or the money that they got for their course, and some of that went to make sure that these other programs were there. It was the way community colleges balanced budgets. And so I guess what I'm asking about is, do we have the capacity that we lost in those times if we were ever to come back? And it's not going to happen in these budget times. But when the budget gets back and we start realizing that we've lost a part of our what makes our healthy communities in these places by not having opportunities for some of these people to take an enrichment course that changes their lives, if we get to the point where we can add it back, do we have the capacity in our community colleges to add back those kinds of things? Do we have the capacity intellectually to offer those courses? Do we have what it takes to put them back if we had the opportunity to do that?
Chair Gelzer and Representative Roblin, emphatically yes. I just last week was at a conference with the adult continuing ed directors, and their continuing question is, so you're going to take a run at this time? You're going to try to get that back for us? And I will say that there was conversation about a year ago this time that it might be worth the slings and arrows that would come with it. But given our current economic picture, because it does add students to the mix, reimbursable students, we won't, but I do know that there are individuals in the community that would jump at the chance to be able to come back to the college and offer a very particular enrichment course that brought something that to that community. And certainly when I'm in the company of the college presidents, what you articulated so well, you must have been in the room, because they clearly believe that some of the passage of bond levies, some of the engagement with the community is perhaps not a direct result, but an indirect result of not of having to charge the 80-year-old to swim in the pool to stay fit. And now it costs three times what it used to. They're not coming around anymore. They're perhaps, no doubt on a fixed income, but unable to continue. So I think that there is untapped resource in both the, on both the instruction side and individuals who'd like to sign up.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming today, Commissioner. And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2208. I'm going to carry over House Bill 2208 until Wednesday, February 11th, by which time we should probably have our fiscal and revenue statements ready. So now I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2208 and adjourn the House Committee on Education.